live with show number 4 of Will Communication here on the Heritage Radio Network, featuring today's guest, Kent Kirschenbaum from the Kirschenbaum Lab at NYU. We'll be talking about all things food, food chemistry, and life. And before I forget, one of the things that's always been in my notes and forgotten on every show is to send a warm regards to Nat the engineer and Lorenzo the producer, without whom this show would be totally impossible. We're broadcasting out of Roberta's here on 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, the other borough of Manhattan, or of New York, and my daughter's favorite restaurant. So we're going to introduce Kent, or allow him actually to introduce himself, and tell us a little bit about himself first.
Hey, Will. So this is Kent, and I run a research lab at New York University where we do a lot of work in biochemistry. And a lot of what we've been spending time lately thinking about is talking to people about the chemistry and science of what goes on in their kitchen and what happens when they cook. And I'm really pleased to join you here because this is not only Lulu's favorite restaurant, but my kids love coming here too. And I just think that that's really indicative that, you know, great food is something that reaches out to every person. And regardless of what kind of background you have, it's something that you can really appreciate and get into.
And you just came back from San Francisco, which is maybe your home and where your love for food was nurtured as a young want to be chemist.
Yeah, just came back a couple of days ago, was up in the hills in Big Sur, and spending a lot of time in farmers markets out there and paying a pilgrimage to places like the Berkeley Bowl Market, which has just the most incredible produce there, and spending time with my kids, showing them some of the cooking that I grew up with, which was really strong Jewish-Italian heritage. And so we made some really nice pastries, like a crostata from some of the homemade jam that I was able to make from raspberries that we got.
So did you have to add pectin? I'm sure what everybody in the audience wants to know right now is how you make homemade jam.
Okay, so this was absolutely super easy. I just got about 6 baskets of fresh raspberries, took them back to my mother-in-law's place, threw them in a pot with let them cook, and just threw in a bunch of sugar and let it boil down. Didn't need any pectin at all.
No lemon juice, no acidity?
A little bit of lemon juice, a little bit of acidity was important. And making the crostata added a little bit more of the lemon juice right before I threw that jam onto the pastry. And that cut the sweetness of the sugar a little bit, and that was a nice element. Put a little bit of lemon peel into the pastry as well.
But I think a lot of what we'd see now as maybe the new Brooklyn or new New York style of food maybe has a strong relationship to some of the things that you might have seen in San Francisco or the Bay Area when you were growing up.
Absolutely. You know, this kind of attention to the foods that grow around you and paying a lot of attention to where the foods come from is something that was really absent when I first began living in New York City back in the early 80s. And frankly, it was a real tough thing for me to contemplate moving back to New York about 7 years ago. But it's something that I've found people do pay a lot of attention to here now. And that type of gestalt from California is not absent here. And so I think that it's become a really great place to think about food, and a lot of people really do appreciate it.
Well, I never forget when I'm on the air, although I do forget most of the things that I'm supposed to say. I never forget to mention that we are actually broadcasting from a shipping container here, which has been converted into a radio studio in the backyard of Roberta's, and we're actually living underneath their vegetable and herb garden, which is right above us.
Yeah. That's another really great thing about what's been happening in New York City lately is this realization that, yeah, you know, we're in this incredibly cramped environment, and we can still make all this beautiful growing stuff happen around us. It's something that the university that I work at, NYU, is now paying a lot of attention to. and they are in the early stages of really thinking about botanical issues and creating a really wonderful working environment by making sure that they have the right things growing all around them. And just looking out this window right now, looking out onto that beautiful borage that's right outside this shipping container in the middle of Brooklyn is just fantastic, because you can take these tiny plots and turn them into just little microcosms of beauty and deliciousness.
Well, can you give me an idea of some of the things that NYU is looking to do with the outreach program?
Yeah.
In this vein?
Right. So let me talk a little bit about the outreach that we've been working on together, Will. And that is trying to get people excited about chemistry, trying to allow people to appreciate the fact that scientific research is not always something arcane and that has little relevance in their daily lives, that scientific research is actually something that can touch them directly. And we're doing that by talking to them about the chemistry of cooking and about kitchen science. So a few years ago, I got a grant from the National Science Foundation, and part of that grant was dependent upon my doing a science outreach program. And they said, we want you to relate that to the type of research that goes on in your lab, which is an area of chemistry called polymer chemistry, which has to do with long chain molecules. A lot of them are plastics that we're familiar with. And they said, we want you to talk to the general public, people who don't normally think about science, about polymers. And I thought, oh, gee, you know, I could talk to them about polyacrylamides and polyisocyanates, and that nobody
but maybe,
will...
Maybe people won't even know what you're talking about.
Yeah, people will just completely tune it out right away. And so I realized that I needed to talk to people about science using terms and language that was immediately understandable and that people would feel was not alien. So I realized that there are these long-chain molecules, polymers, that are present in our food. They're there in our proteins. They're there in our starches. And they are really relevant to what we do on a daily basis because we eat these things every day.
And it's the building blocks for everyone's life, not to mention everybody's lunch.
They're the building blocks of our cells. They're the building blocks of our tongues, the building blocks of our noses, the building blocks of our stomachs, the building blocks of our foods, our drinks, and they're what sustain us. And so there's a lot to sustain us there physically with our nutrition, and there's a lot to sustain us intellectually.
Well, the building blocks of our programming, as I'm always reminded, are carefully orchestrated music breaks. So we're going to take a quick break right now. We're going to come back. We're speaking with Kent Kirschenbaum here on Will Communication. Come back right after this musical break for more on what Kent is doing and how it relates to your life. Will Communication issue or segment 4, the fourth in our series of everything that I find to be interesting. And I've been very fortunate today to have Kent Kirschenbaum from NYU's appropriately named Kirschenbaum Lab. We'd like to thank, of course, our sponsor, TechServe, on 23rd between 6th and 7th. TechServe, your one-stop shop for all things Mac. In fact, I was just in TechServe yesterday to fix my QuickBooks on my current Mac, which was totally outdated. TechServe, your one-stop shop for all things Mac, mine and yours. And we're back here on Heritage Radio Network. If for some reason you haven't scheduled your entire calendar around listening to my show, you'll be able to find this show on heritageradionetwork.com in the archives, where all of the great wizards of past shows will be found. You can even find last week's show with Alex Rige from Chiquito, and I'm sure you can dig up Zach and Jory's show, The Urban Foragers, on heritageradionetwork.com, the archives. And at any time during this show, if you have Ask the Scientist, you'll be able to reach us on our call-in line, which is 718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128 here at Heritage Radio Network, in broadcasting live from Roberta's backyard in Bushwick. And with that limited introduction, I'd like to go back to Kent. And I guess the way that Kent and I met was sort of a funny story, and I'd love maybe Kent to tell you a little bit about how he sort of bumped into me a couple of years ago.
Yeah, so as part of the grant that I got from the National Science Foundation, I realized that I needed to start this outreach effort in the science of food. And I realized that there was no way that I was going to go alone on this because of my limited knowledge. And that I really needed to find somebody in the culinary community who would be open-minded enough to take on a project that really described what was going on a chemical level when we take food and cook it. And so I began to do a little bit of reading, and I realized that there was this whole effort that was developing that was really relying upon new scientific protocols, new techniques, new instrumentation, and applying that to restaurant kitchens. And I came across your name as being one of the people who was at the forefront, and I realized that you were right
in
down...
In my younger days. Yeah. When I've now officially been... I have to thank Florence Fabricant for referring to me as a former avant-garde pastry chef. So I wasn't sure if I'd passed away since the last time we saw each other, or I'm just no longer interesting. But certainly as a former avant-garde pastry chef, I can understand what you're saying.
Well, the other nice thing about it was not only were you at the avant-garde at the time, but you were also in the neighborhood.
I was local, actually.
Yeah, even better than being at the cutting edge is being at the edge that's nearby.
I was at the edge of Delancey Street.
Yeah. So I put together a letter, a couple of pages, if I remember correctly, explaining this notion, this sort of half-baked notion, forgive the pun, about combining science and cooking, and walked into your restaurant one afternoon, handed you the letter, and I said, I'm a chemist, and I want to work with a chef. And I just remember that you were extremely receptive to the idea. And at that point, we decided to form something called the Experimental Cuisine Collective, where we would just gather
people. Which you can find at experimentalcuisine.org. You can find it at everything right now. We are taking over all of the possible domain variations.
Yeah. So I think one of the first things that we realized is that we needed to get people together, both scientists and chefs and the general public who were interested in this kind of thing, and just begin a regular discussion. What can science teach us about what happens in the kitchen? And what can chefs offer scientists as a way to get the public excited about research? And so we've been meeting once a month for the past couple of years. We've had an incredible variety of different speakers come and talk to us. And we've got an amazing slate of speakers lined up for our monthly sessions for the year to come, starting, I believe, with your effort later on this month.
I will resist the... I will resist the temptation to plug myself since it's my show, but on the 16th at Picnic, we'll be talking about dessert design.
Excellent.
Dessert design.
Are we doing that al fresco, Will?
We are doing that al fresco as long as I can figure out how to use a projector al fresco. We are looking for a biodiesel-fueled projector that will work without any carbon footprint. It's very challenging.
And if you can solve that problem, call in 718-497-2128.
That is the first time that a guest has been able to invite you to call in. And I'm very proud to have brought you that guest. So can you tell us, other than, you know, myself, who I feel I'm incredibly interesting, can you talk about any of the other people that we've featured over the last couple of years? Because I think that, and when we do that, I'd like to talk a little bit about this notion, and I think that both you and I have run into this a lot, which is that there's sort of, you know, there's two kinds of people in the world, you know, those who think there are two kinds of people in the world and everybody else. And when it comes to food, I think there's, you know, there's sort of the two camps, right? You either are from, I grow my own vegetables and I pick up everything at the market and I make the perfect tomato salad by slicing the tomato. Or there's the high-tech kitchen crew that has fancy machines and liquid nitrogen, or as I like to call it, the new olive oil from Spain. And all sorts of thickeners and sauces and all this chemical kind of food. And I think one of the things that you and I have been we've certainly been united in our position on it, but I think something that makes that potentially more relevant towards this crowd, the crowd of, I guess, here on Heritage Radio Network and Roberta's, you know, under tomato plants, we associate ourselves a little bit more with the natural. But I think one of the things that I'd like to hear from you is about how there really is no, this concept that there's two camps when it comes to food, you know, one is homegrown and one is high tech, really it doesn't mean anything anymore. And that the people that are most sensitive to how food are grown are also freaks for technique and vice versa.
Absolutely.
So could you speak a little bit to any of our guests who might illuminate a little bit on that subject?
Yeah, so it's been great because we've been able to cover the entire spectrum, I think, and everything from farmers talking about what they've been doing out in Ohio to grow their food sustainably and provide it to restaurateurs, all the way to people who have explained the biochemical basis for what happens when food hits our tongue and the neurochemical pathways that are involved in our responses to food. And so we've covered it all, and I think that what we've found over the past 2 years is that this notion that there has to be a conflict between the growers and the slow food movement and people who appreciate the scientific and technical basis for cooking, there's no conflict whatsoever. And I hope that we can talk about one of the projects that we've gotten involved with, which is stretchy ice cream, and looking at the chemical composition of stretchy ice cream and talking exactly about how science can actually get us back to a better understanding of traditional ingredients.
Well, I think we are certain to have at least a couple of minutes to talk about that after we come back from our second musical interlude here on Will Communication, Heritage Radio Network, heritageradio.com.
Half past 3 in the morning. I can't get no sleep.
Wonderful tunes of my favorite band from 1997, Faithless, Insomnia, I Can't Get No Sleep, which was widely popular in Europe about 10 years before that, but I only found out about it in 97, much like I've only found out about Bushwick in 2009. We're here on Will Communication, Heritage Radio Network, heritageradionetwork.com. The archives is where you'll find all of the great Will Communication, as well as all your favorite other Heritage Radio Network musical and feature celebrities. And we're here, we're sponsored by TechServe, your one-stop shop for all things Mac. The only place to do anything with an Apple in Manhattan, never mind the ridiculous lines at the Apple stores. The only place to go for your Mac is TechServe. 23rd Street between 6th and 7th. We're here with my guest and friend, Kent Kirschenbaum, who we've just been talking about the false dichotomy between nature and technology. And we were sort of segueing into a conversation about some of the things we've been working on that might illustrate how understanding chemical processes can actually help you make things that are traditional and natural. So I'd love, Kent, to talk a little bit about one of, at least one of the things, if not more of the things we've worked on, such as making stretchy ice cream or making your own liquid smoke.
Yeah. So let's talk about the stretchy ice cream. My kids love this one too. So I found out about this ice cream from Turkey, this dish called Maraş Dondurma. And I found out about it in an article from Harold McGee in the New York Times Magazine, and it showed this picture of this guy in Turkey stretching a rope of ice cream. It must have been about 3 or 4 feet up from top to bottom.
And there's movies of this all over YouTube, guys with sticks and teasing people and dragging ice cream in front of them. It's pretty disturbing.
It's wild. And you just think, my God, ice cream's not supposed to do that. What is in that stuff? And for me as a chemist, when I say what is in that stuff, I'm asking that question at a molecular level. So I went about to find out exactly what is in this stretchy ice cream. And I found out that one of the key ingredients is a flour called salep, a ground root from an orchid that grows in the mountains of Turkey. And it's used to create this powdery material called salep, which they add to the ice cream mix.
And there's a funny nickname for the orchid that it grows on, which I'm sure our listeners will not tire of hearing about.
Fox testicle. So,
which is the key for any great ice cream, obviously.
Got to have your fox testicles in there. So the key for me here was, number one, obtaining some of this stuff and trying to see whether or not I could duplicate this dish. And I found out this was going to be a little bit tough because the export of this salep flour from Turkey is prohibited for commercial purposes because of the fact that the flowers are actually endangered because of the fact that they've been over-harvested for use in this food.
This is where it always struck my interest, because this is when we go on the Midnight Express, Oliver Stone, like Turkish prison orchid fantasy that everybody obviously has.
So what do you do when you have some powdery material that you desperately need from Turkey, you need to get it brought into the country? You have,
and not available on Will Powder, obviously, so you have to go to Turkey and smuggle it out yourself.
So I had my dad as a mule, and I had him shove some of this stuff in one of his socks and bury it in one of his sticky shoes.
Bags. His shoes.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, and he was able
this
to...
This is a G-rated network, so I want him...
So I promised him I'd bail him out if he ended up running afoul of the authorities, and we were able to get a hold of him.
That did not work out very well for either the Midnight Express, or I think it was Claire Danes, who was stuck in a Thai prison, but she was not available for this show.
We didn't have any of that drama. We were able to get our hands on the salep when we were able to make some of this ice cream, and we found out, yeah, it was stretchy and fun and bizarre, and it tasted great. So again, you know, like, what is in this stuff? What are the molecules that are responsible for this? And I found out that there was a long chain polysaccharide, a repeating chain made up of individual sugar units called glucomannan. I thought, wow, you know, if I can get my hands on some glucomannan from some other source, maybe we can make a version of this stretchy ice cream that doesn't rely upon, you know, the threat of my dad ending up in the Turkish prison.
And you can say, if all stretchy ice cream lovers from possible imprisonment, which is huge, a huge value added.
And think of the ecological benefit as well. You know, we don't have to strip all these gorgeous orchids from the Turkish hillsides.
Well, so true.
And then
Meryl Streep can make the orchid movie, another orchid movie, if there's still these orchids left.
So we realized that this glucomannan is also present in another food substance called konjac flour, which is a very traditional ingredient. It's been used for making Japanese noodles for a long, long time. We got our hands on
which
some...
Which they even call magic noodles, isn't that right? If you look online, you can find sort of these magic clear noodles, which are pastaless, but made out of konjac flour.
Yeah, you can make pasta out of this stuff, and it's actually... You know, supposedly has great health benefits because of the fact that this
cleans you right out.
Glucomannan is a dietary fiber, and you know, that might actually end up allowing us to create a more healthful ice cream ultimately. Well, we use this konjac flour, and Will, you were really important in helping us perfect the recipe, and we found out we were able to get this stretchy ice cream made out of konjac flour. Tastes great, and as an additional benefit, we found out that this glucomannan has the ability to reduce the cholesterol levels of kids who have suffer from hypercholesteremia. And so, you know, we don't know whether or not ultimately we'll be able to turn this into something that might have health benefits, but it's an interesting angle and just goes to show that when you really think about things on the molecular level, that you might be able to find a way to appreciate really traditional ingredients and use them to make really fun and healthful foods.
Well, and also if you have the imagination to see the different points in the process that you might have something sort of magical or artistic about it, you can have something delicious, something healthy, something, I mean, even more than healthy, I think this is something that we'll probably hope to touch on in future shows, but this concept of healthy food is also different from the concept of healing food. Like, not only is the food good for you, but it may actually be, you know, even better for you in the long run. But I think that having one of the things that I like to stress also about cooking is that, you know, having great ingredients is part of cooking. And this is something we spoke with Alex about last week. And then understanding how to cook or how to prepare foods is an important part.
Right.
And I think one of the things that we're discovering today is that actually understanding the chemical processes involved in food growing or food preparation is really critical towards creating something delicious, beautiful, and even traditional in this case.
Right. I think the other thing that I want to stress is just because you don't have the expertise yourself, don't be afraid to go out and ask. Don't be afraid to knock on the door of your local avant-garde pastry chef.
Or chemist.
Be afraid to knock on the laboratory door of your neighborhood chemist and find out what is it that they know that can contribute to what you want to achieve.
Well, I think that's the perfect sentiment to leave our viewers or listeners with. And we're about to wrap up the fourth edition of Will Communication. Thanks again to Nat the engineer and Lorenzo, my wonderful producer who brought me out to the dungeons of 261 Moore Street here at Roberta's, brought to you by TechServe, Heritage Radio Network. See you next week.
Thanks, Will.